Hi everyone. Welcome to our first real Nitty Gritty installment of Mystery School. We've been laying the groundwork for sure. I've been talking about Peter Kingsley's work, how it is intersecting with C.G. Jung's work, how that is intersecting with the psychedelic renaissance, and my own experiences in all of these areas. And it just seemed really appropriate to dive in and distill some points. And so even though we've been laying the groundwork up until this point today, we're going to talk about love and strife. This is our departure point for today, about a paradigm, a new way of seeing why we are here, what spiritual practice is about through the lens of what Peter Kingsley and C.G. Jung are uncovering in their work. So again, this is a perspective. This is something to challenge and orient into your own perspective, into your own way of looking at things, and see where it fits, see what it pushes up against. Notice if you're resonating on any level with it, and just be curious about that, because this is really, in my experience, powerful, challenging material. But I've never run across anything thus far that is so congruent with my own experiences and is distilling things in a very simple formula. And I don't even want to use that word, because in my walk, spirituality, integration of the authentic self, this is a very experiential practice. And so there isn't a formula, but there are a few guideposts, if you will. That's a term Eckhart Tolle uses a lot, guideposts. And so that this guidepost of looking at these few distilled pointers is where we begin today. But I want to begin first by talking about the beautiful flower moon that we are indeed enjoying right now. It was full just last night, and there has been a lunar eclipse, and you know, the moon is big in the news right now, and probably in your corner of the world you've been enjoying it. I hope so. So I want to share some thoughts on the flower moon, and then we'll just jump right in to these pointers of love and strife. And the protocol for the next three episodes, the next three podcasts that we do, I'm going to do my best to keep them to about 30 minutes, which will be a challenge for me. But I want to offer this beautiful atmosphere of poetry, of silence, and of gently pushing through the use of whatever pointer we are discussing that day into the unknown, and then sitting with that for the week until we meet again. This will release on Tuesday, and then the next two Tuesdays after that, so three Tuesdays in May, we will be in Mystery School, and that will be our protocol, this sort of atmospheric, poetic sensibility with not too much talking, because I want the silence and the discomfort and the resonance to do their own work and just be with you for the week, because indeed that is what my last 2 months have been, digesting this work. I've never put so much time into a podcast, and yet here we are just now getting to the nitty-gritty, if you will. But it's because it's having its way with me, and I wanted to have a little bit of that integrated before I share. At the root, this is all wisdom that we already know, but our modern times are so layered with confusion and an ever-increasing faster pace, that to sit back and just be still is its own medicine. and its own miracle. So here's what I wrote about the flower moon and the color silver, mercurial, glinting, sleek and quick moving, like the shifting inner landscape, passing under moon and cloud cover, refracting the new change, the full change, the change of sovereign space, where the mighty holds the discerning sword, no longer in reflexive attack or puny defense, but now in honor of her, in honor of him, in honor of what now is. A lot of poetry that I wrote for the flower moon had to do with color, and we may get to that, you know, later in our series here in Mystery School. But I wrote about silver in this poem, and that was for a very particular reason, because I was thinking of that discerning sword, and I call on you to call on your own discernment as we travel Mystery School together, because you're going to have to hold up what fits for you and what doesn't. And if you work these practices that I'm going to encourage you to do as quote-unquote homework, you're going to have to decide what you're giving your focus and your attention to, and that requires that discernment. And so in this poem, when I'm invoking him and her, this is not a gendered thing. This is about the totality of all of the roles we play, and some of them are active and some of them are passive. And it's getting to that essential nature of ourselves, where we are in our wholeness, where we are in our divinity. So our spirituality is something that's very personal to each of us. And you may have been raised in a particular faith. You may have left a particular faith. And I just want to say straight away that the ideas I'm going to be sharing with you, and indeed that are most resonant for me, are very much pointing to the divine within us. And I'm not saying that in any sort of egomaniacal or narcissistic way, because you could sure take it that way, but that's not what I'm about. I'm talking about moving from that still point where we start to see that we are indeed made in the image of something so profound and something so powerful, and accessing that still point to experience and let that portal, if you will, flow through into the circumstances of our lives. So this is about almost being a human bridge, if you will. We certainly have our human side, but we also have our divine side. And I'm not trying to tread too much on your personal belief system, but this may rattle it a bit or resonate. Just see what happens with that. But I'm calling on that inner spark within us that is home always, that is in its beauty and in its joy and in its peace and in its love and in its darkness as well. Because that still point can watch all of the human play, all of the human drama, and still be at home. So as we move through this lesson today, that is what I'm invoking as we move through the lessons of the next 2 weeks. just as a bit of a refresher, Peter Kingsley is a tremendous scholar. But if you'll remember, he really takes academia and the quote-unquote rational Western approach, linear approach to life, very much to task. So his books are thick with notes and notes upon notes and all of his scholarship. So I encourage you to, if that is important to you, or if you would like further reading, to delve into that. That is not my purpose for Mystery School here. I'm taking these pointers and offering you my perspective from my own experience and offering a bit of spaciousness about how we can do this in real time, meaning our waking life, and how we can experience our divine nature more and more and more in our waking space. And so Peter Kingsley, if you remember, has two things that really travel with how he writes and how he speaks of these pointers. And that one is the trickster nature. He looks back at the pre-Socratic writings of Parmenides and Empedocles. And again, you can go for the details in Peter Kingsley's books. But those two writers, those two ancient philosophers, were very much of a trickster nature when they were talking about these things, because they had to be, because the mind needs a trick played, if you will, so that the wisdom can sort of penetrate in through the side or in through the back door. Because we are so devoted to the rational in this culture, things have to be turned on their head, or somewhat comical, or in the voice of the fool, or the upside down, for us to get it, for us to reawaken to what we already know ourselves to be. So that's one way of piercing those layers. So there's a trickster quality to both his writing. I would definitely argue with Jung's writing. In Jung's sense, he talked often about personality number one and number two. And number one was his sort of external circumstances, the family he was born into, the family he created with his wife, with his children, his professional acquaintances, and, you know, the burgeoning field of psychology and all of his writings and all the rest of it. So that's personality number one. Personality number two is who he encountered when he had his encounter with the unconscious, which is the essential self, which is the divine self, which is that archetypal home that we all belong to, that is infinitely loving and powerful, but it has all the terrors too of all of the human experience. And again, our task is to hold that still point where we're at home and watching the play of that. So personality number one and number two, depending on who was speaking, it was really tricky and of a trickster nature to sort of follow Jung's work sometimes. And both his critics and his devotees will say that, you know, it's hard to know sometimes. He seemingly contradicts himself in his writing. Well, Peter Kingsley offers that depends on if it was personality number one or number two speaking, and even the dance between those two, because we have to turn the rational on its head for the wisdom to get there. And that note about the rational, if you remember a couple of podcasts back, to Peter Kingsley, the rational originally served wholeness. So that's what we're seeking to do in Mystery School, is everything we're about, even though we're touching at these little pointers, at these little ideas that can help us reorient, recompass our lives so that we're in that sort of bridge and portal state where the divine is flowing more readily through us into our everyday, into the dimension that is this material world. The rational is serving the whole. It is serving wholeness. It is not about dissecting things down into all their pieces so that they can fight with each other or, you know, hierarchically categorized, if you will. There's so much dissection and hierarchy in our external world, and that's not how the rational, according to Kingsley, in this perspective, was originally to function. So just those gentle reminders here. When we're talking about, just real loosely, I'm going to just hit the huge highlights of Parmenides and Empedocles' works. Parmenides had this vision with a goddess who gave him wisdom. This you could describe as an altered state, much like Jung's encounter with the unconscious. You know, it was definitely a peak experience for him, and much of his writing flows from that experience. Empedocles adds to that work and then also brings in the senses and the importance of the senses. And we'll talk a bit more about that, what I mean by that as time goes by. And he also talked about the importance of the elements. Okay, so that will make more sense as we move through this. But basically, you know, these are where these writings are coming from. And I just want to read a passage straight from Peter Kingsley's book, Reality, because this is him talking about Empedocles and the divine dance of love and strife. Okay, and just by way of setting up a receptiveness for this, I want you to imagine being the director of a play. You are the director. You know, and when I think of being in productions in high school, you know, all the lights are up on the stage. There's all this creative unfolding and directions and lines and movement and choreograph, and the director is usually out in the auditorium in the dark, you know, taking it in, watching, seeing what needs to change, and speaking directions then to the cast, to the actors, to the production, to the scene. And it's so easy as human beings to fall into the seductive sleep that we are the actors on this stage, that we are the roles that we are playing. Mother, father, child of an alcoholic, sister of someone who died, Republican, Democrat, somebody from Ukraine, somebody from Russia, somebody from Mexico, somebody from the U.S., somebody who believes in pro-choice, somebody who believes in pro-life. All of these are roles, an actor on the stage. And in our human walk, we become seduced that this is who we are. These roles that we're trying on for size, and moving around in and seeing if that's a fit and seeing if it has something to teach us or not. I would argue that what Jung and Peter Kingsley, and definitely in my own life, is a very valuable practice, is to remember that you are the director. You are to watch the roles, even if you're living them. But watch them with a certain amount of curiosity and wonder, and a good dose of humor is definitely helpful. You are the divine director. And what you choose to breathe in to the production on the stage is the conscious work that can really affect change in our lives, in our external lives. It's not the characters or the roles or the actors going around screaming at each other or doing 100 different things to create change that really matters. This is in the hands of the director. So here I am touching on that divinity. And I'm not saying that the divine in us is the ultimate. What I'm saying is, in my experience that I shared with you about my own psychedelic moment, where I got to slip behind the veil and experience something so explosive and powerful and beautiful and loving that was beyond my ego and beyond my roles and was absolutely timeless and was absolutely like the engine of life creating itself every single present moment. When we touch that, it's not like I have access to all of it, but I had access to that precious piece of the divine that I am expressing right now. And you have a precious piece of it, as does everybody on this planet, as does all form of life, is part of the stage, is sharing a piece of the divine, knowing itself. And so I'm not being narcissistic or inflated. There's a good psychology word, inflated, in talking about that I'm the all-knowing for everybody. But if I'm touching that spark of the divine that is a portal into this world, then I'm going to be engaging my role on the stage in a very different way. And just imagine, you know, just imagine if all the characters in your life, however beautiful or challenging they are, imagine all the circumstances in your life, if seen through that lens, how it changes things. So right now I'm going to read from Peter Kingsley's book, Reality. And quote, he says, "Empedocles knows his way around eternity like a wildcat around its lair. He defines his ground with the clarity of someone whose eyes see straight into another world and with the faultless consistency that only a true sorcerer has the power to value or understand. The process of coming together and drifting apart, of breathing in and out, of being born and dying and being born and dying again, goes on and on. Like anything else that never really happens, it has no end. But even so, every single time that Empedocles refers to this cycle, he describes it in just the same way, presents it in precisely the same sequence. First, there is the joining through love. Next, secondly, subsequently, comes the destruction and dissolution by strife. Time after time, when referring to the whole of existence or to the elements that make it up, he talks about the movement towards union as coming first, and only then being followed by the opposite process of scattering." So basically, Empedocles' writings bring in the elements, and we're talking about earth, fire, water, and air. And he's talking about those elements coming together and joining things and being separate and distinct again. And this theater, if you will, is happening through all of our human walk. And there are times in our lives where things are flowing together into relationship. And there are times when things are distilling apart into single moments, single opportunities. And that singularity could, if taken to the nth degree, become earth, fire, air, or water in its purest form. And so it's just a way of talking about all of the theater that's happening in our human walk. And there are things we learn about ourselves in Aphrodite's dance of love and the joining. And there are certain things we learn about ourselves in the strife or the separation. And it's these two forces, the coming together and the separating, the coming together and the separating, endlessly in this dimensional human walk. And his great instruction to us is to remember that it's all part of the play. It's all part of the dance. And even the things that we find that we most love. Okay, let's use that word. Aphrodite is the goddess of love. This is still part of her illusion. This is still part of the play. So imagine being your authentic self as the director, and there are roles and actors on the stage experiencing the forces of love, the coming together of the elements, and strife, the coming apart. And the trick is to know they're all roles. You are the still point in the auditorium, the direct link to the divine. And to the extent that we can be the observer, the witness of the entire play, whether it's in quote-unquote love's moment or quote-unquote strife's moment, is essential. As long as we see this is the play, I'm not identifying with any of these roles, then that portal remains open from the divine home through us into this external world and into all of our circumstances. That's the trick. And that takes an incredible amount of focus. It is not difficult. It is our natural state. It is our natural nature. But all of these layers and the seduction of the roles gets us lost in that. And so my hope for you for the next week, and I'm continuing in this work myself, is to think of the play. Think of who you really are as being the director, this link to the authentic self, to the other world, if you will. And the roles are the roles. And strife gets our attention, doesn't it? You know, it certainly does. We don't like the forces of strife. They're great awakeners. They really are. But what I found so profound is to start to realize that Aphrodite's spell, if you will, and again, we're using her because this is the Greek tradition and she is a Greek goddess. But Aphrodite's spell of love, of everything coming together and being wonderful and harmonious is also not you. And that's really important. That's revolutionary in staying in this stillness, because there's love and there's love, okay? There's love acting itself out on the stage, maybe in relationship, maybe with a mother to a child, or even in the dramatic versions of that, love for a career. But you know what? Love becomes love lost at some point, doesn't it? Okay. And so eternal love, you know, with the capital L, is originating from that still point, that otherworldly, authentic perspective of the director. That is home. That is infinite love. That is life force love. That is love we can't even define with human words. It's not the human experience of love. So just to have this awareness was so incredibly helpful to me as I disengage from the external world so that I might be a greater beneficiary of it. This is not about, you know, retreating to the mountaintops and never engaging in life again. In fact, it's quite the opposite. It's saying, if you're going to be here as a human being, how do you do this skillfully? How do you do this effectively? How do you actually create change? And this is primal ground zero for an effective practice in doing so, according to these traditions, which are really resonating with me right now. I'm experiencing their power. It is changing my dream life. It's changing my waking life. It's changing how I'm relating to myself, because I'm bit by bit sinking more easily into the director's chair as opposed to being these roles on the stage. But to be watching for love's roles, and Omal call that Aphrodite's spell, is really important, because some of those roles we really like, you know, love being a mom. But my infinite authentic self is beyond mom, right? And if I get too over-identified with mom, A, I drive my children crazy, and B, I only limit myself, and I cease being the portal that the divine can flow through into these roles, because I'm thinking I'm the character as opposed to the director. So in the week ahead, contemplate what it is like to get caught up in love's roles and strife's roles. Notice in the external world with your neighbors, on the national stage, on the international stage, all the dramas of love and strife acting themselves out. And notice if people of presence, people who are seeking to problem solve, are approaching that as though they're just one of the characters thrashing about on the stage, or if they've entered the director's chair with some stillness and some clarity and some inspiration, some true inspiration from the other world. Call it heaven, call it the divine self, call it the underworld, call it the unconscious. There's a lot of ways to talk about it, but it's home. If these traditions resonate for you, it is home. We're not what's happening on the stage. And so I'm going to leave some music and some contemplation right now, some space for that, just to carry us on out. And we will meet again with just, again, a simple practice. It's simple. It is not difficult in terms of understanding it, but it is challenging to apply when we're triggered or when we're caught up in the play. But see what this does for you in the next week of Mystery School, to just have that awareness. And until next time, take good care. everyone. If you're enjoying this podcast, remember to hit subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. And if my work is nourishing your heart and imagination, consider supporting the Apothecary Podcast. Just follow the links to make a contribution. And for the full scope of my projects and offerings, including my weekly newsletter, visit lorigreen.net.